So I'm going to talk about science and faith, but first I'm just going to show you a little bit about the Anselm House, because that's not like Doug probably is going to ask about it. So where I work now is an organization called Anselm House, which is very much actually in the tradition of Francis Schaeffer and Labrie, which is fascinating. So Francis Schaeffer worked in the mountains in Switzerland, right? Almost like a retreat thing. People went there, spent some time there, similar to here on the, in the mountain in Rochester. People spent some time here. But one of the things that Schaeffer always also had a heart for was the university. But he never worked at the university. But some of other people that came through Labrie have kind of adopted the university as kind of like their place where they do ministry. And so that is what Anselm House is doing as well. So Anselm House is what we call a Christian study center at the very heart of the University of Minnesota campus. So this is the campus of the University of Minnesota. So this is the East Bank that goes all the way even further there. And here's the hospital right here. And then right here where this blue house is, that's Anselm House. And the university is actually all the way over here. This is going to be the new medical center right here. And so we're going to be right here at the heart of the university. So what is it? So here's our building. Again, you see the students walking by and things like that. There's retail and office places and things like that that we rent out to other people. But we are actually in the basement of this whole building. And in the basement, we run a study center, which is basically a place where students from the university can come and hang out. And it feels a little bit like a Starbucks maybe, but it is not a Starbucks, because at Starbucks, people don't know you by name. And in our place, we actually want to get to know the students by name. So when they come down, the people who are at the front desk, they actually often know the people already, because people come down quite a bit more, and they greet them. And so we really want this to be a place of hospitality, Christian hospitality, where students from the university can come hang out and are in being known. And students actually tell us and say, like, this is the only place on campus where I'm not a number, but where I'm a person. And it's very important at the university today, because the university today is so fragmented and is so kind of like siloed that so many people just don't feel that they belong anymore. Even if you read, for example, the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is kind of like it's not a newspaper, but it's kind of like an email kind of like thing that a lot of like academics are subscribed to. The word belonging shows up so often in kind of the Chronicle of Higher Education. That's just amazing. Like, everyone is talking about belonging, but no one knows how to do it. We do it, not because we know how to do it, but because of the gift that God has given us, namely a building where we can actually have people hang out. So we run a study center, so students can come there, study. We provide food. Food is always good, right? So we have free coffee, free tea, sometimes free snacks, especially during exam weeks and things like that. And we do it like what we call rhythms. So we do prayer every day. And so the students in our place who are studying there, at 12 o'clock, we invite them to join us for prayer. Whether Christian or not Christian, doesn't matter. And whether they join us for prayer or not join us for prayer, that doesn't matter, because they're still going to hear the prayer, because we're doing it right in the middle of our place. And so they see it and they hear it and experience it, that Christians are different, that they talk differently about things, that they find their strength at a different place, namely above instead of like in kind of knowledge below. We do a tea time 3 times a week. So it's a little bit after Labrie a little bit, right? So tea time. So we sit around the table, we bring out snacks, we bring out coffee, tea, actually not coffee, we bring out tea. And we have conversations. And it's just amazing the conversations that you can stir up around the table when people just have a little bit of an opportunity to slow down and sit down and where you can actually have a conversation face to face, look each other in the eye and talk about meaningful things. And so often that students come to us and say, like, this was like, well, this is amazing. Like, why do you do this? And you have an opportunity to talk about those kind of things. So we have a big table, big wooden table. We have actually two of those, and we just sit around there and just talk and be hospitable and engage them, see where they're at. I had a 2-hour long conversation a couple of months ago with like an atheist student who had so many questions, but also so many objections to Christianity. This is amazing. And when I had to leave to go home, one of our students who was very involved at Anselm House to continue the conversation, because he was part of that. And eventually he gave the student a copy of C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity, and the student hopefully is reading that. It's amazing, right? Those kind of things. So more tea time, different people this time. There's someone studying. Here's our kind of fireplace, really popular in the winter. that kind of stuff. So you see kind of like a homey atmosphere, right? And how many university buildings have homey atmospheres? Like zero, right? It's all kind of like concrete and concrete jungle almost at most universities. We have a library where people can check out books and just read and things like that. And we have food, lots of food. Foods, like there's something about like hospitality and food that just draws people in. And so this was actually food after a lecture, but we have food at lots and lots of different times throughout the year where we just show people that we love them. So we do lectures similar to what we do here. Here's, we had a Christian neuroscientist from Stanford speaking at the university. And we drew about 300, 350 people or so, just listening to him. And he talked about science and faith, how he balances that. Which is amazing that you can do those kind of things at a very secular campus, right? And invite people, and a lot of neuroscientists who are not Christians, but who know him, came to that lecture and heard a Christian neuroscientist talk about his faith, which is like the witness of something like that is just amazing. We also used him. So here, as you can see, the people right there, there's a full house. We also used them for what we call roundtables. And those are a little bit more what we call missional activities. We don't call it that way, but internally we call it missional. Where we kind of talk about a topic that is really important for academics. So like one of the big questions, so to say. So this was about neuroscience and free will. Like with modern developments in neuroscience, where more and more people start believing that we are nothing but machines, right? Can you still talk about human beings who are able to make choices? Or is everything determined by electrical currents and hormones and things like that? Obviously, a difficult debate, but a lot of people, so I invited about 1,000 people across the university. In the end, about 80 people came, which is great. And about 60%, about 60 people actually of the group were not Christian, and about 20 were Christian. And so we're talking about topics of free will and neuroscience. And this guy here was talking about his Christian faith in that room and had like discussions for about an hour over food afterwards about how you think about this kind of things, which is again amazing. So 80 people or 60 Christian, not Christian scientists or like academics talking about what does it mean to be human? And how does the Christian faith, how do you think about it? And how can religion inform those kind of different things? It's amazing to have those kind of conversations. So they're a little bit more missional, and we really try to show there that the Christian intellectual tradition, and that could be Protestant, that could be Catholic, that could even be Orthodox, has something to say about those kind of questions. Something that is generally not being accepted in academia at all. So that's what we are. We're a place where students can come and where we kind of try to challenge faculty at the university to think deeper than what their normal fields often allows for. And it's great. It's challenging. It's incredibly challenging because there's pushback. And it's also very rewarding. So you can see the kind of standing in the tradition of Francis Schaeffer, talking about the big questions and things that are meaningful and trying to help people to see that there's actually more in life than just the things that they're working on. All right, let's go to what we're talking about tonight, science and faith for the rest of us. I call this science and faith for the rest of us because so often science and faith is seen as a very technical topic, right, for experts. So I'm a cosmologist. I love this kind of stuff. But you guys are not cosmologists, so would you even talk about cosmology, right? No, because you don't know anything about that. Not really, right? But it's difficult, right? So many people say, like, well, cosmology, Big Bang, actually, I don't know about it. I'm scared about those kind of different topics. So I don't want to engage in kind of science and faith conversations, right? That's true for a lot of us. Evolution, same. Like, I'm even scared about topics of evolution because I'm not a biologist. I want to be careful what I say there. Neuroscience, right? I'm not a neuroscientist. So what am I saying? What if I meet someone who knows a lot more than I do? Right? So do we engage those kind of topics? Often not, because they're so technical that we kind of try to, that many of us shy away from like topics that engage science and faith kind of at this interface. And I don't think that's necessary. I do think that all of us, whether we are scientists or not, have something to say there. And I'm going to try to make the case tonight that we can actually say something about it, even if you don't know anything about science and faith. Actually, I hope you know something about faith, but maybe not about science, right? You don't have to be an expert to be able to talk about those kind of things. So that's kind of my aim for tonight, that I give you a little bit of confidence that actually, even though you're not a scientist, that you still can talk about topics that interface with science and faith. Here's a question. I'm going to make use of some research that was done in England, in the UK, by the Thiels Institute and the Faraday Institute, or the Thiels think tank, actually, and the Faraday Institute. And they asked about 5,000 people to answer some questions so that are kind of at the interface of science and faith. And here's the first one. And we maybe can talk a little bit about it before I show you the results. So this was one of the questions that I asked. On a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is completely incompatible and 10 is completely compatible, please indicate where you think is the relationship between science and religion. So if you think about science on one side, religion on the other side, are they totally incompatible? Are they kind of some half-half, or are they fully compatible? Yeah, so kind of like that, you can see the scale right there, right? So what do you think about that? On a scale of 1 to 10, where do you think the relationship between science and faith is?
9.
So compatible, almost compatible. Okay.
I think 8.
8, okay. Very compatible as well. Okay, good. 10, fully compatible. All right, good.
1.
1. Someone needs to say it. So Doc is, okay, so 1, like totally incompatible. Science and faith do not mix at all, right? Okay.
I have to say 10.
10, okay.
I think it's
true.
Like
some
word science.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Okay. But I'm very aware that what people think when they have science. Okay. Okay, good.
Say it, watch your words. Wait.
You? Who's, someone is talking. I don't see who is talking.
Sorry. It fluctuates, you know. Depending on what you're talking about,
yeah.
There's something that could be incompatible mm-hmm. based on what aspect of faith.
Okay. Yeah. So,
what is unexplainable versus like what is sort of natural, what religion and science agree on?
Yep. So it depends. It depends on your terms, right?
Yeah, I guess, yeah, I'm going into more specifics.
No, we'll get there.
That's why I said 1.
Yeah, okay.
Because historically, religion and Christianity are incompatible.
Mm-hmm. Religion and Christianity, yeah, true. It depends on who you talk with, obviously. But yeah. Okay, good. So here's what came out of that research. About 57% of people say it's incompatible. 26% strongly incompatible. 30% compatible and 8% strongly compatible. So, and this was it was about 5,153 people who answered on this. That's interesting, right? So kind of the general kind of idea of like science and religion in England, right? This is in England, is that it's incompatible. What do you do with that? Well, someone already said, or actually several people said, like, it depends a little bit what you mean with the terms. So let's dive a little bit deeper into that. And let's dive also a little bit more towards the different fields, because what is science, right? So the question then is there a conflict, right? So a lot of people in England would say, yes, there's a conflict. What do you think, like, the general person here in the United States would say? Yeah, there's a conflict, right? Like the general person, like if you just go on the street and you just ask someone here right next door to the Mayo Clinic, like, hey, what do you think about science and religion? Are they compatible, incompatible? A lot of people would say like they're incompatible. Yeah, depends a little bit whether they're religious or not religious. But a lot of people generally would say they're incompatible until you start thinking a little deeper. But what kind of incompatibility is that? What kind of conflict is there between science and faith? And a lot of people they don't know, right? They might say, so, oh, evolution. And what is an incompatible? Well, I don't know, right? So you should ask a little bit deeper, and a lot of people probably don't really have answers there anymore. So what is the conflict about? That's the next question, right? Like, what is the conflict really about? If you think there's a conflict, what do you think then is the conflict between science and religion or science and faith? And where did the conflict start? It's not a really good question, right? So a lot of people would go back to, where did conflict really start between science and faith? Or science and religion?
Galileo,
yeah. What did you say?
Scopes trial,
yes. That's much more recent. So that was kind of like the big thing of the last, like, what is it, like 30, 40 years or so, Scopes trial? When was the Scopes trial? In the 80s, right?
25.
Oh, was it 1925? Yeah, much earlier. Okay. In the Renaissance, okay.
I think therefore I am.
Okay, Descartes, okay.
Darwin.
Darwin, yeah. So what you hear a lot, what I hear a lot when I ask my students, for example, is like Darwin, the beginning of evolutionary theories. I hear Galileo a lot as well, yeah. So where basically Galileo was burnt on the stake, right? Because he proposed like an heliocentric worldview where the Earth is not in the center anymore, but the Sun was in the center. Was he burnt on the stake? No, he was not, right? But that's one of those myths that goes around. A lot of people talk about, like, oh, Galileo was burned on the stake, was killed, or was thrown in jail. No, nothing like that.
Someone told me just yesterday that Kelvin put him on the stake.
Oh, wow. Kelvin killed Galileo. Yeah. So lots and lots of myths are going around about like actually what happened. There's actually an historian of science, Harrison is his last name. And I don't know what his first name is anymore. Well, doesn't matter. But he has this famous quote where he says, if someone would tell you that in the 1600s there was a conflict between Israel and Egypt, no one would believe that that claim would come with would be approached with a lot of skepticism. And that's true because like Egypt didn't exist in 1600 and Israel didn't exist in 1600 either. The territories, right, where they are right now, they were there, and there might have been some conflicts, but Israel wasn't there, and Egypt wasn't there either. So you can talk about the conflict between Israel and Egypt going back all the way to the 1600s, but it's not really the same thing. And the same way is true. Same is true for science and religion as well. Science was the way that we talk about science right now is not the same science as in the 1600s. The way that we talk about religion and faith is not the same faith and religion is in the 1600s. So you can say, oh, like Galileo, that's where it all started. But actually, it was not. Yeah, science and faith was much more enmeshed with each other, had totally different presuppositions, totally different ideas than what it is right now. Like our understanding of science as this naturalistic process and methodology is only something from the last 100 years. And before that, that was a very different view of what actually science was. Anyway, so where did the conflict start? No one knows, right? Or like, it's not that no one knows, but there's very different opinions. And again, it comes down to like, what do you actually understand with the different terms and things like that? And how do you know these kind of things, right? How do you know this? How do you know that the conflict started with Galileo? Well, no one knows that. You just take it on authority, you believe it, you read the newspapers, you read the sensational headlines and that kind of stuff, right? Kelvin killed. Like that is going to make his own life. Like it's going on Twitter and then half of the world believes this. Not really, but like that's how people believe it, right? People take it on authority. They don't do the research themselves, they take it on authority. As we take almost everything on authority, right? And so science and faith, we need to think about the terms. We need to think about like what actually is the conflict. How do we know those kind of different things? Can we kind of think a little bit more critically about those kind of things instead of that we just take things on face value or the way that kind of the stories go around, so to say. All right, make sense a little bit? Okay, so this is the report. It's a report by the Theos think tank. It's a Christian think tank in England. And they wrote a report, really interesting actually, Science and Religion Moving Away from the Shallow End. And they kind of used kind of a pool analogy. They said there's a lot of noise being made in the shallow end. And we should actually move the whole discussion to the deep ends, but there's a lot more interesting questions. And so this is empirical research from the Theos tank. They interviewed between the fall of 2019 and the fall of 2020, 101 experts, most of them like in the sciences, most of them not Christian, about their ideas about science and religion. Very, very interesting. And then between May, basically in May and June of 2021, YouGov, which is kind of a big polling website in England, they did research and they had about 5,000, a little over 5,000 responses on their questionnaire. So very interesting. A lot of people also not Christian. So this is not like a couple of people like low number statistics. This is actually kind of fairly grounded research and a good understanding of what actually people in England believe, which can be translated to the United States, even though like the climate here is a little bit more polarized than in England. England's a little bit more secular. And it's a little bit more polarized here. So it might be worse here. So here's a question that I asked. There's strong, reliable evidence to support the theory of evolution. And this is the answers. 42% strongly agrees, 32% agrees. And then you have a whole bunch of like very, very low numbers of people who disagree and strongly disagree. Yeah? So there's strong, reliable evidence to support the theory of evolution. That's one of the questions that they asked. Here's the next question. I have difficulty believing in the theory of evolution. Again, so very, very strong. Not as strong as numbers as last time, but 46% strongly disagrees, 24% disagrees, and then there's some lower numbers who disagree or kind of disagree or strongly agree or neither disagree or disagree. So this kind of shows a little bit that evolution itself is not very contested in England, right? A lot of people actually don't really have issues with kind of believing in the theory of evolution and things like that. So it's not evolution itself that's kind of conflict, so to say. That makes sense? So what then is the conflict? Where does the conflict lie, so to say? So here's a question about cosmology. So the more we know about the universe through astronomy and cosmology, the harder it is to be religious. That's an interesting question, right? So the more we know about the universe through astronomy and cosmology, the harder it is to be religious. Our second question, the theory of the Big Bang makes it hard to be religious. Kind of similar vein, but a little bit more towards the theory of the Big Bang instead of like the more we know about the universe. Okay, so what do people answer here? Theory of the Big Bang makes it hard to be religious. It's about 39% that agrees or strongly agrees with that, and about 30% who disagree or strongly disagrees. So there's more people who actually agree with this statement, the theory of the Big Bang makes it hard to be religious, than disagree with that, but there's not really kind of like really significant. If one is 39%, the other one is 31%. What about this last one? The more we know about the universe through astronomy and cosmology, the harder it is to be religious. It's exactly the same numbers on the agree side as on the disagree side. You see that? It's exactly the same numbers as on the agree side as on the disagree side. So what do you do with that? Yeah, so is cosmology like or the Big Bang, is that kind of a hindrance for believing? For about 30% of people, it is. 36%, for 36%, it's not. So that's some interesting data. What about this? What do you think people would answer for something like this? So there's some difference, right? Some significant difference in evolution, lesser of a difference in cosmology. The more we understand the human brain for neuroscience, the harder it is to be religious. What do you think people would answer there? Very strongly agree with that. Like the more we understand the human brain, the harder it is to be religious. Or would people disagree with that? People disagree with that. Yeah. So there's a sense in which like the human brain is a very interesting thing. And it's not so much like the more we know about the neurons right here, the more kind of God goes out of the picture, right? That's actually not true for a lot of people. Yeah. What about this one? The more we understand the human body through medical science, the harder it is to be religious.
Again, it's like if you look at, I mean, let's just look at the ear. Mm-hmm. How in detail the tiniest little itsy bitsy bone can make. How do you not believe?
Okay. So that's what probably what some people say. But if you have a non-Christian, for example, right? The more you understand about the human body through medical science, the harder it is to be religious. I don't know whether they would even like disagree or agree with that, right? Yeah.
I think the more replicable that our knowledge gives us, mm-hmm. the more harder it is to be religious, because we can say that, oh, yeah, we can do that, so it's not.
Okay, so the more you can replicate it, the harder the sciences are, right? More like towards physics or whatsoever. The more difficult it is to believe in God, and if you have more like the softer sciences, the easier it is to believe in God, something like that. Yeah, less applicable. Okay. Our understanding of the human mind through psychology makes it harder to be religious. Or what about this one? Our understanding of the world through chemistry makes it hard to be religious. Do you think a lot of people would agree with that? Maybe. Right? What about this one? Our understanding of climate science makes it hard to be religious. Or the science of geology makes it hard to be religious. So you see here kind of a little progression, right? And probably less and less and less people would say, like, actually, like, this makes it more difficult to be religious, right? So when maybe for cosmology, people say, yeah, this is hard to be religious. Maybe for evolution, it's hard to be religious. But kind of like climate science, like, doesn't really make it much harder to be religious. And so that's what the data says as well. More and more people start kind of disagreeing. So there's a big gap between how many people disagree with these statements, how difficult it is to be religious, then people actually agree with the statements. So there's a gap of about 10%. Geology is a little bit closer, but for example, climate science, there's 44% who disagrees with that, or strongly disagrees with that, and only 24% who kind of are on the agree side, who said like, yeah, climate science makes it much harder for me or for people in general to be religious. So then the question again is like, where's the conflict, right? Where do people see this conflict, and what is kind of the content of this conflict? So obviously, if there's a big gap right here, for example, climate science, then there is not a whole lot of conflict, right? A very low percentage of people would say like that this is really kind of a barrier to be religious. But in if you remember cosmology, two slides back or so, where was it? This one. These numbers are the same, right? So the same. So just as many people agree as people disagree. And so that basically means that it's a lot more people can imagine that it's more difficult to believe in God or be religious than, for example, like geology or neuroscience or something like that. So the question, where are we? Right here. So it depends a little bit which field you talk about, right? That's kind of like the big takeaway from here. So some fields kind of induce kind of this conflict a little bit, or kind of like where people have this feeling, yeah, this is the conflict, and other fields, people don't really feel that there's a conflict. Yeah. Correct. Correct. So if you ask people who are in the disciplines what they actually think about this, then you get different results. And often what actually happens there is that the extremes are going to be highlighted a little bit more. So people are either strongly agreeing with this or strongly disagreeing with that. So there's a little bit more polarization, because people are either very nuanced and say like, actually, I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference, right? Or people are not nuanced at all and say like, absolutely, like you cannot be a neuroscientist and a Christian, or you cannot be a geologist and a Christian. And so you see that the extremes are going to be highlighted a little bit more. Yeah. I might skip over this one for now. So here's a couple of observations from that survey. This is kind of verbatim out of the report. On closer inspection, tension with specific sciences is much less than with like the whole idea of science in general. Yeah, so when you talk about science in general, I didn't show that picture here. I should put it in there as well. But when people talk about the incompatibility between, oh, actually I did show it. That was the very first one, right? So this one, where was it? This one. So science and faith are incompatible, science and religion are incompatible. About like, what is it? Like 70, 80% or so people say it's incompatible, right? Incompatible, strongly incompatible. But when you go to the individual sciences and ask the same question, basically, it's not this big gap between people. So very interesting. So where are we? So on closer inspection, tension with specific science is much less than with science in general. And if you ask people about the view of religion and science, they're likely lean towards incompatibility. But if you ask them about religion and specific science, for example, neuroscience, medical science, chemistry, psychology, geology, or even cosmology, they're more likely to say that on balance, it doesn't really make much harder to be religious. So very interesting. Yeah? So that almost suggests that people have an idea about what science is and what religion is, but it doesn't actually, that doesn't trickle down to kind of the individual sciences. Right, there's kind of a certain narrative, there's a conflict between science and religion. But when you start talking about like which science it is, no one knows exactly why there's a conflict between those different kind of things. Similar point can be made for specific religions. So they also kind of were able to split up people by different religions. Perception of hostility between science and religion is greater than it is between science and Christianity, or between science and Islam. It's also very interesting. In other words, it seems to be a conflict of image rather than substance. That's interesting, right? And so even so often we kind of forward, or like, how do you say it? Like perpetuate this narrative of science and faith, even among Christianity, that there's kind of this conflict or whatsoever. And we never really specify what it actually is about. Does that make sense? Okay. So this is what they say. If we adopt the narrow angle lens on the relationship between science and religion, and especially the big three, evolution, Big Bang, and neuroscience, then and then present it as a series of binary choices, evolution versus creation, Big Bang versus God, neurochemicals versus spiritual experience. And then thereafter, a single model, harmony or conflict, we naturally steer the conversation to a restricted area where there's likely to be a lot of shouting and noise, right? In effect, the shallow end of the pool. So that's where Richard Dawkins operates, right? A lot of shouting, a lot of noises, all kind of caricatures about Christianity and caricatures about science, but not really diving deeper. That makes sense a little bit? Yeah? So if you kind of like present it in kind of like the evolution, Big Bang, neuroscience lens, and then present it as a binary choice, it's either or, and then put like this whole narrative of harmony or conflict on top of that, then you steer people towards this kind of perpetuating this narrative. Well, if you really go dive deeper into kind of the individual sciences, then that conflict is not present. Yeah. So how do we get out of this model, right? That's a big question. So how do you get to the deep end of the pool? So this is what we say. If we opt for the wider angle lens, taking on the relationship, we'll begin to see a rather more complex picture with pockets of antipathy, anxiety, and incompatibility, but also with areas of ambiguity, complexity, and harmony. If you zoom into the smaller areas and look a little bit more at the nuance, it's actually a much more kind of complex picture than kind of like the stereotypical kind of narrative of science versus faith or science versus religion. Yeah.
You will get a lot of, so if you zoom into like a smaller scale, you'll get a lot of different answers, perspectives.
Yeah. Yeah, for example, so when I talk with like cosmologists, right, my own fields, and I talk about being religious, I don't really experience a whole lot of conflict. Every now and then I do, but there's a lot of nuance in kind of like the conversations that we can have, instead of that we project this kind of narrative of science against faith on top of that. I've had conversations where someone heard I was a Christian and immediately turned around to you and said, oh, you're one of those people. So I've had that. But much more, I get actually, huh, that's interesting. Like, let's talk a little bit more about that. Yeah. And it's super for any of the different fields as well.
Yeah. It sort of changes from like fluctuates from like field to field, or different areas will agree more or less.
Yeah. There's a lot of fields, and for those of you who are kind of like in the sciences, you will probably experience a lot of harmony between the Christian faith and what you see in your own field, right? And you don't experience a whole lot of like the conflicts. The conflict is the narrative that's put on top of it, instead of that it's something intrinsic. There is going to be questions, and there is going to be friction in certain places, and I'll highlight some of those in a little bit. But it's not that there's this kind of this default kind of picture of like, whatever the science you're in, there's always in conflict, whatever with the content of your faith. It's a much more nuanced difference. Okay. All right, so science and faith in conflict. Is there a conflict? There might be conflict, right? So there's probably areas where there is conflict. But it's not that the whole field is in conflict with the whole field, the whole field of cosmology with the whole field of like a religion or faith or whatsoever. Something like that a lot of people kind of like by default initially will take. What's the conflict about? Well, we'll dive a little deeper into that. Where did conflict start? That's always a really interesting question again. And it didn't start with Galileo, right? There was conflict, but it was not between conflict and between science and faith. It was actually between different people who wanted certain things. And it was actually much more a new emerging science sponsored by or done by the Christian Galileo versus an ancient science based on the Greek, Aristotle, right? And Greek philosophy sponsored by the church. By kind of a church that is totally stuck in its tradition and ways to do things. So it was more like a Greek worldview sponsored by an static Catholic church over against a new emerging worldview sponsored or basically developed by a Christian scientist named Galileo, who was willing to go a little deeper and who was inspired by an opportunity to actually study creation and see things. So again, it's not science and faith there. It's two different kind of worldviews that were against each other. And then the question, how do you know? What authority do you have? Whose authority are you following? It's actually a very, very important question. All right, let's talk a little bit about the terms then. Right, someone else brought it up already. Like, what do we mean with science? And what do we mean with religion? Or what do we mean with faith? So what is science? I'm just going to throw it out. What is science?
Systematic approach to gaining knowledge.
Okay, systematic approach to gaining knowledge. Good. Okay, observable. So you're observing something or manipulating something. Yeah. Yeah, so there's an element of experiments in most of the science, not all of the sciences, right? But most of the science, there's an experiment that you can actually manipulate, repeat things over and over again to kind of get deeper levels of confidence, higher levels of confidence. Yeah. Okay, so you have an hypothesis and then you test it. You test that hypothesis and you can say like, well, we can confirm this hypothesis or we can deny this hypothesis. Good. Okay, lots of different things, right? So lots of elements of the sciences that come in there. So here's what the UK Science Council says. The pursuit and application of knowledge and understanding of the natural and social world following a systematic methodology based on evidence. So like, that's okay. And then here's a couple of different things that I highlight. Objective observations, evidence, experiment and our observation, induction, repetition, critical analysis, verification and testing. Lots of different things. A fairly neutral kind of like definition of what science is. Is this true for all the sciences? No. For example, my own science, cosmology, there's not a whole lot of manipulation that you can do there and repeated testing, right? We cannot go to the stars and say, hey, star, like go a little, rotate a little faster. I want to see what happens. Or this galaxy, can you go a little bit backward? I didn't really see what happened there, right? It doesn't really work that way. But when it's bench science here on Earth or like lab science here on Earth, it kind of works pretty well. But not for every science is going to work. But it's a nice try, so to say. Here's a couple of a little bit more polarized definitions of science. Actually, a couple of quotes. This was this was a letter written by some Nobel laureates and State Academies of Science against ID teaching in school. I don't know exactly when this was written, but science is devoted to formulating and testing naturalistic explanations for natural phenomena. Yeah, so naturalistic explanations for natural phenomena. What's the difference here? What is added here to the world of science? Yeah, exactly. This is a natural world, and we only use naturalistic explanations for that, right? So that's a much sharper or more polarized definition of what science is and what the UK Council for Science actually wrote down. Here's another one. Rigorous attachment to natural explanations and is ruled by methodological naturalism. Again, same idea. Yeah, so ideological naturalism. That's what you always could do there, right? So
that's partly why I said my 1%. I think a lot of people do when they think specific sciences like, you know, chemistry,
yep.
they don't think any conflict. But when they think science, they often think a natural explanation.
Yep. Yep,
science
exactly.
is what brings you the natural explanation.
Yep.
So religion brings you
the supernatural, actually. Yeah.
They must be in conflict.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And so once you go to those more polarized definitions, right? Or sharper definitions, or definitions motivated not by describing what happens, but motivated by a certain agenda almost. That's where you see the conflict showing up. Yeah. And obviously this was in a certain agenda because it was against ID teaching. Yeah. Here's this is just a screenshot that I took because I didn't have time to kind of like work a little bit more. But this is a lecture given by Nick Spencer. Nick Spencer was the main author of the report that they used, or that I kind of showed you earlier. And he gave a lecture in January of this year. You can find the whole thing there. If you want to listen to the lecture, I'm happy to send you the link. He said, like, science, if you really start thinking about it, is actually a very complex creature. Yeah? There is no one science. And it's really difficult to describe science in one uniform way. There's all kind of different sciences. That's one thing, right? There's geological science, biological science, natural science, all kind of different fields. All those fields operate differently. All those fields have different discourse like languages, so to say, different objectives. And they don't even all agree on how science actually should be defined, things like that. And then science in general itself has like, a lot falls under there, but a lot of things are never clarified when it comes to science. So this is what he put up there. So science can be kind of described by method, subject, presuppositions, objectives, values, and institutional structures. And it's really difficult to contain all of this in one definition. So what do you think about method? Well, hypothesis, testability, practice, replicability, accuracy, quantification. So it's kind of like this. There's kind of like a method to kind of like get information, right, out of out of nature, so to say. What is it about the subject? So it's natural sciences, social science, economic science. It's material, right? It is something that we can kind of like touch, so to say. It's not about supernatural things. It's about material things. It's often observable. We cannot do science on unobservable things. So it's often observable. And then there's often a lot of presuppositions under the science that we never talk about. Right? So for example, that the sciences follow laws. Well, we talk about that, but we take it for granted. And we don't never talk about where the laws actually come from. They're just a given, right? So you just assume that there are certain laws that that describe nature itself. We also assume that nature is intelligible, that we can actually understand it, that we can systematize it. Why that is, no one knows. No one actually ever talks about that, right? The fact that like that's, here's my favorite example, that we can develop mathematics and whole differential equations, systems of differential equations in the abstract, right, without any concrete application to kind of reality. And then suddenly we figure out that we can use those differential equations to describe phenomena in physics. How's that possible? Like, no one knows. Like, there's like this kind of symmetry between kind of the world of mathematics and the physical world is something that we just have absolutely no idea about. And everyone just takes it for granted. Einstein said, the most unintelligible thing about the universe is that it's actually intelligible. Like, the thing that we understand the least about is the fact that we actually understand it. That's crazy, right? And no one thinks about this kind of stuff. It's just taken for granted. And that world is real. There's actually a real world out there. Why, like we touch it, we feel it, but it could be a big dream. But like scientists don't think about it that way. Although there's a couple of scientists now who think that we're living in a computer simulation. And so then the world is not real anymore. But then the question is, how are you going to do science in a thing? Well, there's all kinds of ideas. So here is a couple of presuppositions that are presuppositions that can never be proven by science itself, right? Science cannot prove that the world is lawful. Science cannot prove that the world is intelligible. Science cannot prove that the world is real. The presuppositions, you need to use them. But we never talk about them. But it's still part of science, right? You cannot do science without assuming these kind of things. Some of the objectives of science is cumulative, right? We build upon other things, which is already its own thing. Like standing on the shoulders of giants basically means that I assume that Newton was right and that Einstein was right in my field, for example. Have I done those experiments? No. I just take it for granted. I take it for granted. I trust it, right? I take it on authority and I trust it. That we never, something again, that we never talk about. A lot of people think like scientists should be able to prove everything and experiment everything, right? I'm only believing the things that I can prove. That's total bogus. No one does that, right? Like everyone takes things on authority. Like the vast majority of the things, like all the textbooks that you read, you just take them on authority. You never prove like that gravitational constant is 9.81. I've done some experiments, but like that's about it. Yeah? But then the big G, 6.67 times 10 to the negative 11, like I've never proven that thing. So predictable and useful. So there's a couple of kind of objectives for science. Values, also something that we never talk about, but we deeply value them and they're never part of like the way that we talk about science. So that science is collaborative, right? That you can, most of the time, you cannot do science in solitude anymore. Like in your little room somewhere, you just have to do it collaborative, that you need to have a posture of humility, that you need to be curious. Science doesn't say anything about that, right? Science doesn't tell you that you need to be curious, but the people who do science are curious. So it's an essential part of being a scientist, that you're curious, but it's never a part of like the definition of science, right? It's part of the practice of science, but never part of the that you need to be self-disciplined, that you need to be honest. That is actually a big part of instinct and intuition that goes into the practice of science, right? I get my best ideas not when I'm sitting in a lab, but when I'm taking a shower. Why is that? Well, my intuition is working, right? There's something going on there. And then when I go to the lab and use those ideas, they're certainly very important. But I didn't get them doing like things in a lab. I got them in a totally different context. So intuition, like something that is not scientific at all, right, is something that's actually very important in the process of science. Even like the benzene molecule, I think it was that one, where the six carbon atoms are connected to each other in a big ring, was found because someone had a dream about a snake biting in its own tail. Is that correct? You guys, I see some people nodding. I think that was actually how people found, like, got the idea for a benzene molecule, a snake biting on its own tail in a dream. Anyway, we never talk about it that way in science, but it's part of science, right? Intuition, education, all these different kind of things. And then all kind of like institutional structures, qualifications, recognition, communication, publication, employment, like the whole publication kind of like mill, so to say, is part of like science. But again, we never talk about it. When we talk about science, we talk about these kind of things, right? And we forget about all the other things. It's all about this kind of stuff, hypotheses, testability. The scientific method is just this part. But this is also science, right? So science is much wider, much bigger, and that kind of stuff. And many of these kind of things, right? There's not a whole lot of conflict, so to say, between what we see as science and what we see as kind of like faith or religion. What about religion? Similar thing. So can be characterized by lots of different things, but here's like one nice way that Nick again characterized it. Transcendence. There's a belief of something that transcends the natural world, so to say, an existence of a transcendent being that is active and personal. Right? That's true for the Christian faith and for the Abrahamic faith, not always true for kind of some other religions. But this is kind of like the way that I certainly understand the Christian faith. There's a belief, there's an object, like there's something that you do, like there's a level of evidence that Christian faith is not just all kind of like dreams and vague kind of ideas and things like that. There's actually like it's based on reality, right? It's a historical religion. And there's sources of this evidence, and it's reasonable. We can think about it. We can reason about it. It's not totally incoherent. It's actually, they can systematize it. And it's significant. There's a commitment. So when you think about religion, you commit yourself to certain things, certain practices and rituals, certain behaviors, certain bodily expressions and ethical things. It's formalized to a certain extent, right? In theology, doctrine, in ethics, systematic theology, and that kind of stuff. And there's often a formalized commitment, so not just personal commitments, but also commitments that go to a kind of a level of kind of organized institutions. So collective rituals, ceremonies, laws, hierarchies, offices like pastors, priests, archbishops, and all those kind of things, institutions. So religion itself is much broader than only kind of like what some people think as like doctrine, right? That's sometimes what people think, oh, religion is doctrine. It's actually not. There's many, many more different things there. So the interesting thing now, and there's a very interesting comment that they made. Religion is often being portrayed in those science and faith conversations as a very simplistic and monotonous, so to say, like system of belief, so to say. And science is always as a noble kind of enterprise. So here's one way that they explain it, and there's another slide coming up. Religion sees itself as being the quest for truth, whereas science, in its strictest sense, and in its Sunday best, as if it were, is the quest for provisional understanding, which may be revised later. Yeah, so religion, quest for truth, and science, and a provisional understanding of, like, also kind of like understanding of this reality. So that's a very significant for the debate between science and religion, because often the debate slips into the comparison of a normative or theoretical version of science. Yeah, so kind of like this is the scientific method, it's objective, it is kind of like highly structured, it's naturalistic, so to say, versus a descriptive or actual or a messy version of religion, right? It's kind of like doctrine, or it's ugly people who kind of like are hypocrites and that kind of stuff, who believe things that you cannot believe anymore. This comparison is often made between, on the one hand, the methodological rigor of science and the neutral, objective, disinterested activity of scientists, and on the other hand, the grubby reality of religion and sometimes ill-informed, sometimes corrupt, always fallible behavior of religious people. Yeah, so often when you talk about science and religion or science and faith, science is kind of put on a pedestal, right? It's objective and it's disinterested scientists who try to be kind of like get the best information out of like nature, so to say. And religion is often being portrayed as kind of like, yeah, like messy, right? Like people who don't agree with each other, who have like all kind of weird ideas and that kind of stuff. Yeah, yeah. No wonder then that you get these caricatures, right? No wonder then that you get these caricatures. So there's no such thing as a scientific method, but rather there's various scientific methods, right? There's not one science, there's different sciences. Science itself is much broader, much wider than what generally a definition can capture. And there's many, many presuppositions and ideas underneath there that are not even part of science, but that are basically taken for granted. And then the methods of science employed in science draw upon a whole range of principles and virtues that are not justifiable in terms of science itself. Certain, such as creativity, intuition, perseverance, humility, all those different kind of things. It also requires certain structures of authority to maintain its existence and its trustworthiness, right? Peer review, publications, and that kind of stuff, which is kind of codified, right? You cannot argue with that anymore because this is the way that it goes, but this is the best way to do it. No one knows. And the exercise of reason within the scientific method is a good deal more complex than it is sometimes imagined, right? Like, it's not always this objective thing, because the practice of science demands a degree of faith in certain things, although that word itself is hotly contested on account of its what it is associated with often. The actual practice of science does often not live up to the theoretical image of it. Scientific skills are acquired through apprenticeship, right? It's not that you go to school, the professors dump all the scientific information that they have in your mind, and then you're ready to go as a scientist, right? No, you just learn from other people who make mistakes, right? People have to apologize for certain things. So it's apprenticeship, right? It's not like here you go, now you know it. It's learning from other fallible people. Scientists are not neutral. They're not objective. They're not disinterested. A lot of scientists are actually very interested in their results. They're not disinterested. And rarely as open and receptive as the method says they should be. And the process of fitting data and theory or data and model together is complex and commonly draws on a scientist's commitments, imaginations, intuitions, hunches, or sometimes sheer stubbornness. So again, science, the practice of science itself is much broader, much wider, much more complicated than just this label science suggests often. Make sense of it? Yeah? And obviously I can do the same for religion as well. So here's a couple of nice quotes from that they gathered from scientists. How long do I have, Jock? Do I need to finish up soon? Keep going. Okay. Scientists have moral commitments to truthfulness, right? Everyone has that. To honesty, they usually value hard work, they hate negligence and deceitfulness. So quite a number of moral things there, which clearly are not justifiable in terms of science, but scientists have to proceed with them. That's pretty interesting, right? I said that science isn't faith-based, but it is. Because I haven't read a paper on global warming, I haven't looked at the studies, but I believe in global warming because everyone tells me to believe in global warming. That's the authority in my current world in the same way that 200 years ago, the authority would be the church, right? Same thing. But I said, like, have I done an experiment to prove like that the gravity, the strength of gravity is like 9.98 or 9.81? No, I haven't. Actually, I have. But like most people have not, right? It's a fairly easy experiment actually you can do. But but there are other things that I haven't done, but I still take them. I take them on authority. I take them that I trust them. And so when people say like scientists should be able to prove everything, no, that's total bogus because that's totally impossible. That's not even practical. You have to take the vast majority, like 99% of what you know, probably even more, just on trust and authority. Similar to faith, right? So then where really is the conflict? All right, let's dive a little bit into some things. I wanna go through cosmology and neuroscience. And I move a little bit between, or like from kind of like the who did it, kind of God versus Big Bang, right? To kind of like some kind of deeper questions of maybe metaphysics or epistemology or whatsoever. So I'll explain what those kind of ideas are. And the same I'm going to do for neuroscience. Are religious experiences real? Or is there actually more and deeper questions that we can ask about who we, what it means actually to be a human? Okay, here we go. So kind of cosmology, moving beyond like the who did it, the God versus Big Bang, or the natural versus the supernatural, which is often kind of like a question as well. And what kind of other questions can you ask? Well, for example, you can start talking about like metaphysics. Well, this is a little scary term, right? It comes out of philosophy. And it basically asks questions about like, what is the nature of reality? Like, what kind of world do we live in? Yeah, so is this superficial question would be, is this a natural versus supernatural world? But you can also go to deeper questions, like what are our prior commitments that we bring to the table when we do science? What do we think are the basic ingredients of reality? Is it like particles or like string theory? Or is it consciousness? Some people think it's actually consciousness. And what about the laws of nature? What about the existence of mathematics? So those are kind of deeper questions that you can ask that go beyond like who did it, right? Is it God of Big Bang? But it's a merely influence kind of like the whole theory of the Big Bang. Questions that most people actually don't think about, right? What's the nature of reality? Most people don't think about it when they start thinking about cosmology. But there's also are actually really important questions that go deeper. Now, I do realize those questions are still technical, right? They're still not easy questions to answer. But those are kind of like some kind of like hints towards like other questions that you can ask that move a little away from kind of like who did it and like the shouting on the shallow end of the pool, like, oh, that's God, no, that's like by itself or whatsoever. To kind of like deeper questions, to deeper end of the pool, to kind of start exploring a little bit, like what actually are the questions here that we really should start thinking about? But what about the epistemology? So how do we know what we know? That's another kind of area. How do we know these kind of things, right, when it comes to Big Bang and all the kind of theories that we have about the Big Bang? If we can test those, how do you know those kind of things? Do you take them on authority? Is it speculative? Even if it's speculative, like what is the degree of confidence that you can have in those different kind of things? Yeah.
I was always taught that the Big Bang theory came from the basic demand of religion.
Yeah, so the Big Bang was developed by a Belgian priest, Catholic priest, in 1927, who heard about Einstein's theories. So Einstein has two main theories, right? Special relativity and general relativity. And so general relativity is a very difficult theory. And Einstein kind of like this gave the framework for general theory, general relativity. And then certain people started applying that to certain objects. So initially kind of black holes and that kind of stuff. Einstein applied it to the sun as well and was able to predict like what would happen during a solar eclipse. And then Lemaître, that's the Belgian priest, he was the first one to say, like, actually want to apply those theories to the whole universe. So in a very kind of like abstract way, he applied them to kind of like certain, he put certain presuppositions that he, certain kind of like ideas first about the uniformity of the universe. And then he said, like, let's apply these equations to the whole universe, see what happens. And he found that the universe was either expanding or collapsing. And he said, like, well, clearly the universe is not collapsing, it's kind of alive. And so he came up with the theory that the universe actually came out of a big explosion and that that explosion is still kind of going on, so to say. So that was, he didn't call it the Big Bang. He had a term for that, the cosmic egg that exploded. So that's one of the things that he talked, so comes like a cosmic seed that exploded that gave rise to the whole universe. He also talked about time, and he talked about a day without yesterday. So he really saw that there's a beginning of time. Even though he was a Belgian priest, he was a little bit more hesitant in saying that God did it. But he was clearly talking about those different kind of things and not seeing a whole lot of conflict between kind of these kind of theories and kind of even the theory of kind of, or not the theory, the stories of creation. Which other people later also said, like non-Christian astronomers and cosmologists, they kind of like later said, like, There's a famous quote from a cosmologist who says something like, cosmologists have been searching forever for kind of the Big Bang, something like that. And they kind of climb up this mountain. And then when they get to the highest peak, they are greeted by a band of theologians who've been sitting there for centuries. Basically finding kind of confirmation almost, that's what this cosmologist said, about like the beginning of the universe, the beginning of time, beginning of the material world, all kind of notions that are kind of natural in the Bible, and that cosmologists at that time actually didn't want to believe. They believed in an eternal universe. And so Lemaître was the first one to say at that time that the universe actually had a beginning. And so that very much conformed with his Christian beliefs. So very interesting story, actually. So epistemology, how do we know if you cannot test those kind of things? Or in cosmology, one of the main theories right now is the multiverse. It basically comes out of the idea that this universe is extremely fine-tuned, and that we cannot really explain why this universe is so fine-tuned. So it's so fine-tuned that if you would change some of the laws of nature that we know, like gravity and electromagnetic forces and things like that, you would change a little bit, by a small percentage, this whole universe would not be conducive for life anymore. There could be no life in this universe if you just change some of the laws of nature a little bit. And that's acknowledged by every physicist and cosmologist. Everyone like realizes that this universe is extremely fine-tuned. But it presents a big problem, right? Like, what do we do with that? Like, why is this universe not here? Why are we here? That's a big question. Like, if this universe has like zero chance to be here because it's so fine-tuned, we're here. So how did it happen? And so one of the popular theories right now is like, there's not only one universe, there's billions of universes. And all those universes are just a little bit different. And we just happen to live in a universe that is conducive for life, where the laws of nature are exactly right. And that's where life came into being. Okay, great, right? Except the question is it science? Can you test it, right? All those billions of universes, is that more like, is it science, right? Can we go there? Can we test those kind of things? If I say like, this is my hypothesis, like, where's my test, right? Something like that. Or is it more speculative? Or is it more faith, right? And so that's a big question. Is the multiverse, is some of those modern scientific theories that you primarily find in physics, are they even real science anymore? So those are deeper epistemological questions that you can actually ask. What about anthropology? Like, anthropology is basically the study of the human. Who are we in this cosmos? Right? Like, what is our place in the universe? Is it just us here on this earth? Is there other life in the universe? If there's other life in the universe, how do you compare to that? If it's just us in this universe, what does that mean for us and for our significance and for our future? Those are really big questions that are coming out of cosmology itself, right? That move a little bit away from this God versus Big Bang idea, but that are really important questions to get a bigger and a better handle on actually what actually are the consequences of the Big Bang theory. And also, does it actually make sense to live in a certain universe? Right? Does it make sense to live in a universe where that is teeming with life, but that we've never seen, right? Does it make sense in a universe where there's billions of universes that we have no access to? So those are questions that you can ask. Do we have a special place? How is it that we can understand this universe? That we are conscious in this universe, even like going back to kind of like the idea of like biological evolution, so humans came into being, were evolved over billions of years or millions of years, eventually formed a brain, and that brain now suddenly is able to understand this universe. How is that possible, right? How is it possible that our brains are able to understand this universe? Crazy ideas, right? What value do we associate with ourselves? So lots of questions that go much deeper than just like who did it, but have all to do with kind of like the science and faith debate. And some of those questions, some of them are very technical, right? But many of those questions actually touch immediately on who we are ourselves. And you can ask those questions to other people, so to say, who have like those kind of like, who come up with like this idea of the Big Bang or whatsoever. Right, so even if you are in conversation with people who know that you're a Christian and you come in conversation about like the Big Bang or something like that, and they come up with a whole idea, here's a couple of questions that you can ask them, so to say, that are at the interface of science and faith, right? but it go beyond this kind of the shouting, like, it was God, it was the Big Bang, it was God, it was the Big Bang. And it actually go much deeper and explore many more of, like, questions, deeper questions there. That makes sense for this? Obviously, like, you can write them down. I can also give them to you. There's plenty of other questions that you can ask as well. It's just kind of like showing that there's other questions that you can ask that are still as relevant for kind of like science and faith, but go deeper than just like kind of like the either or kind of dichotomy or kind of like, how do you say that, like conflicts model. I'm going to skip over this one. What about neuroscience? Kind of moving a little bit beyond the question of materials or electrical currents and that kind of stuff versus spiritual experiences. What's some other questions that you can ask? Here's a whole list again. Metaphysics, is there a spiritual component to you? That's kind of the same thing. I should have put a different question there. Epistemology, are empirical methods able to provide a full picture of who we are as human beings? Right? Can you use science to get a full picture of who we are as humans? That's a good question. And you can think a little bit more about that. And I don't think anyone really knows, right? Or even if people have like all kind of ideas about neuroscience, then this is certainly a question that will kind of like pose them and will probably help have them a little pause. Say like, I need to think a little bit more about that. But for example, another question, what does make humans distinct, right? So we are humans, we have a brain, we're conscious. What does it actually mean that we're conscious, right? And in what ways are we distinct from other animals or whatsoever? Hermeneutics is often talking about text, right? So hermeneutics, like how do you read text? But you can also use it, how do you interpret certain things? So how do you interpret neurological data? Is there always one way to interpret that? Is there always a straightforward answer if you see a certain signal and you say like, this is the way that I can interpret this kind of thing? And who gets to decide that, right? Who gets to decide the complex emotions and experience that we have, that actually is being represented in certain ways in our brain and things like that? An ethical question, how far can you go with experiments on humans? That's a big question. And what constitutes genuine progress? Or go a little deeper, AI is a big race right now, right? And like implants that even you can actually have signals going into from your brain into kind of like things and from other things into your brain back again. Are there boundaries to the development of AI? And who gets to contribute to and decide on shared issues of moral significance? Who makes those decisions on how far you can go with AI? Big question right now, right? Does Facebook make those decisions? Google? Does the government of the United States make the decision? But what if someone in China goes further? Who makes those decisions? Massive questions, right? Massive questions. And so when you talk about neuroscience, and you can ask this question for all kind of other fields as well. It's not just like what does it mean to be human and things like that, but actually like there's so many questions that influence our daily life often that you can actually open up. And that still are on this interface kind of between science and faith. Here's a couple of like interesting quotes that I'm just going to quickly read through that. And then I'm almost finishing up. The basic position is that consciousness is just an extra property of matter. This is actually a very interesting position and something that a lot of people right now kind of like are moving into, because no one knows exactly what consciousness is, right? Are we a material being and then do we have a mind, right? That's a big question. So this is what we call dualism. Or is it more like that it is kind of like enmeshed? That there's kind of like matter and minds are kind of like something, or is there kind of like, can you put a property and conscious property onto matter, so something like that. So this is a very interesting position. It's called panpsychism. So the basic position is that consciousness is just an extra property of matter. Fundamental particles have some incredibly simple forms of experience, yeah, and the experience of the human and the animal brain is somehow derived from that. This doesn't necessarily take us in a spiritual direction. Could be just, oh, right, matter has this extra property of consciousness. And a lot of my fellow panpsychists are completely atheist secularists. Because there needs to be a way to actually explain kind of our experience inside of us. And if you're not a dualist, right, if you don't believe that humans have like a separate kind of mind, then somewhere this experience needs to be located. And a lot of people are moving in this direction that actually every little particle has some little, not really mind, but some kind of form of experience as kind of an extra property, or kind of consciousness as an extra property. And then if you put a lot of them together, like this table right here is maybe a very low level of consciousness, but I have a much higher level of consciousness. And suddenly that makes me conscious. Panpsychism. Look it up on Google. There's actually a lot of people who are kind of moving that direction because consciousness itself is so difficult to explain. And especially if you don't want to be a dualist, you need to have some alternative. And this seems to be interesting for people. But here's someone else. There might be a background assumption that I'm so strongly committed to a naturalistic understanding of the universe that the amount of evidence you would have to provide me is so sky high that you will never meet that burden. So this person actually recognizes that they have a really high level of high bar for evidence to have someone else convince them that there's actually a supernatural component to the universe, that you will never reach that, even though there might be a supernatural component to the universe, right? And so they realize, when you start talking with people, they realize that they actually are, that it's not like so much is there a supernatural component to the universe? But actually, am I putting up a bar that is so high that you will never be able to convince me that there's a supernatural component to the universe? And so people start realizing those kind of things when you start thinking about some of the more complex things. So it's a lot more complex than what most people actually make it when it comes to science and faith, right? Here's a little video I want to show you from the Theos. It's 2 minutes long, and then I have one more slide and I think I'm done. And this little video suggests that instead of talking about conflicts, it suggests like these are conversations that we just need to have. Instead of like working out of this conflict model, we should just see them as conversations, and we should not be threatened by having those kind of conversations. All right, here we go.
Things look very different from far off. Perceptions change when you see the details. Many people look at science and religion and see conflict. But what if what looks like conflict is actually just conversation? People talking, agreeing, disagreeing, sometimes passionately, about the biggest questions in life. Is the universe simply pure chance? Or are its laws fine-tuned for a reason? Is evolution too wasteful to be the design of a loving God? Or is there a direction, perhaps even a purpose to it? When did we become recognizably human? And what makes us different from other animals? Is the brain just a complex machine? And if so, can humans ever truly be free? The questions are as much about religion as they are about science. Are spiritual experiences a sign of something deeper? Or are they simply an illusion of the brain? How should we read holy books? Are creation stories bad science or good poetry? If nature obeys laws, is there a lawgiver? And is it possible to believe in miracles? These conversations are ultimately about who we are and how we live in the world. Are humans material or spiritual or both? Should we look to science, religion, both or neither for moral guidance? Is altruism just an evolutionary trick? Or is it a glimpse of who we were made to be? These are science and religion conversations. Sometimes our opinions feel worlds apart, but to others they seem to align. Will you watch from a distance, or will you join the conversation?
All right. Let's go here. So the picture of conflict between science and faith, often a result of the big three, cosmology, evolution, and neuroscience, does not do justice to the wonderful relationship between science and religion. think so many different things, especially for those of you who work in science, you just can attest to those kind of things, like I can. There's a beautiful relationship between science and religion, even if it's already, for example, for the wonder and the sense of awe that you kind of experience. Science and religion are often misrepresented and caricatured, right? Like we take little pieces and we put them against each other instead of taking the full picture of what science is, or actually what the individual sciences are, and what the complexity of religion is. Under the surface of conflict, there's a whole world of deeper and more important questions to be explored. Some of these are still quite technical, right? So I'll admit that. But many of these touch on all of reality and are relevant for each of our lives. And getting acquainted with these kind of questions is important for the rest of us, not just for experts, for a fruitful Christian witness in our culture, and a deeper understanding, I would say, of science in our own churches as well. All right, that's where I'm at. Thanks for your interest. And if you want to email me with more stuff, there's my email,